Following are comments on William Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, Act II. I am that merry wanderer of the night. Robin Goodfellow, or Puck, a mischievous spirit of nature, explains the quarrel between Oberon and Titania over an Indian boy each wants to adopt and raise. In Act II, Scene 1, our introduction to the enchanted forest is to hear the dialogue of Robin Goodfellow and a fairy who has come to prepare the way for the entrance of the fairy queen, Titania. The fairy has a job to do, flitting everywhere in the vicinity and being careful to, quote-unquote, dew her orbs upon the green and, quote-unquote, hang a pearl in every cowslip's ear before the queen, with her retinue, arrives. Act 2, Scene 1, Line 9, and Line 15. The Norton gloss tells us that by pearl, the fairy means dewdrop. Robin reminds the fairy that the fairy king, Oberon, is due to, quote-unquote, keep his revels here tonight. Act 2, Scene 1, Line 18. He says the king is, quote-unquote, passing fell and wrath, because Titania, quote-unquote, as her attendant, hath a lovely boy stolen from an Indian king, and jealous Oberon would have the child, knight of his train, to trace the forests wild. Act 2, Scene 1, Lines 21 through 22 and 24 through 25. The king and queen are presently separated over the custodianship of this little boy, each preferring to bring him up in their own gender-specific way. Perhaps we are to understand that Titania would keep the boy just as he is, while Oberon would initiate him into maturity in the masculine style. If the female fairy attendant to Titania evokes the more delicate micro-effects of the natural world and its processes, Robin should remind us of nature's rougher qualities. He acknowledges with apparent pride to his fairy companion that he is exactly, quote-unquote, that merry wanderer of the night she suspects he is. Act 2, Scene 1, Line 43. He is the one who causes no end of chagrin and trouble for the careless or foolish humans who become subject to his mischievous efforts. We may think of Gerard Manley Hopkins's poem, Pied Beauty, with its love for, quote-unquote, all things counter, original, spare, strange, whatever is fickle, freckled, who knows how. And add to that fine description the impish gleam in Puck's eye. He is all things unpredictable in nature, things and phenomena that double back and make fools of us when, in our carelessness and determination just to live our lives, we least expect it. Let's call him Shakespeare's uncertainty principle, at least for this play. None of this is to say that Puck is a malign spirit. As Oberon's helper, he is mischief in its lighter aspects, not the murderous mischief invoked by Mark Antony in Act 3, Scene 1 of Julius Caesar. Perhaps we can best understand Robin Goodfellow as the obverse of the chaste power that overlooks Shakespeare's play, namely Diana, virgin goddess of the moon, whose significance is signaled by the impatient Theseus at the play's outset when he says that the moon impedes his desires. I do but beg a little changeling boy to be my henchman. Oberon and Titania argue over an Indian boy that they both want to raise in their own way. They also regret the trouble that their discord is causing humans. Oberon conceives of a plan to make Titania relent. Still in Act 2, Scene 1, we meet the fairy king and queen, Oberon and Titania. Along with Prospero's island in The Tempest and the Forest of Arden in As You Like It, the fairy-haunted forest outside Athens is among Shakespeare's most beloved green worlds. A place for what Oberon will later call, quote-unquote, fierce vexation, but also a verdant, charmed circle for the sorting out of the discords and misunderstandings that beset human and divine lovers. Magical transformations happen in this, quote-unquote palace would, but Oberon and Titania are beset by the same jealousies and grudges as the play's mortals. Control of a changeling Indian boy's future is only part of what separates this immortal power couple. Titania, it seems, is quite jealous of what she's certain are Oberon's erotic adventurism and dalliances. She accuses him of inhabiting the spirit of classical pastoral poetry. Quote unquote, in the shape of Corin, she says, he has, quote unquote, sat all day playing on pipes of corn and versing love to amorous Phyllida. Act 2, Scene 1, lines 66 through 68. Also in question is Oberon's possibly sexual connection with Theseus's soon-to-be bride Hippolyta, whom Titania calls Oberon's, quote-unquote, buskined mistress and, quote-unquote, warrior love. Act 2, Scene 1, line 71. The suspicion is mutual, since Oberon thinks Titania has a connection with Theseus, too. It sounds as if these two need a fairy-capable marriage counselor. But in any case, Oberon is minded to inform Titania of the troubles their recent history together has caused for the human world over which they partly preside. The weather-based effects Oberon catalogs sound severe, quote-unquote, contagious fogs that cause riverbanks to overflow, with consequent failures in the crop-growing cycle, and so forth. Act 2, Scene 1, line 90. These problems, says Oberon, have wrought misery and havoc among the human beings who are, for all their otherworldly pretensions, deeply affined with and dependent upon the workings of the natural world, both great and small. When even in little things nature is out of kilter, the rhythms of human life become contorted, confused, and everything is less intelligible, less bearable. Quote unquote, no night is now, says Oberon, quote unquote, with him or Carol blessed, and we are to understand that that is no small thing. Act 2, Scene 1, line 102. Together, Oberon and Titania are supposed to sustain and bless the mortals in their care. They have one job, as we would say, so they need to stop wrangling and get it done. Oberon thinks the solution is simple. Titania just needs to deliver that Indian child into his custody. He says, quote unquote, I do but beg a little changeling boy to be my henchman. Act 2, Scene 1, lines 120 through 121. Unfortunately, this request is greeted coldly by the Fairy Queen, who has something of the great Queen Elizabeth I about her. Titania is particularly attached to this changeling boy since his mother, a votary of hers, died while giving birth to him. Her answer to Oberon, then, is, quote unquote, for her sake do I rear up her boy, and for her sake I will not part with him. Act 2, Scene 1, lines 136 through 137. In a broader sense, Titania also seems concerned to maintain her sphere of authority by withholding from Oberon something he dearly covets. If that's so, the fairy monarchs have their own elfin war between the sexes going on. Oberon decides on the spot to punish Titania for her obstinacy, but he knows better than to confront the powerful demigoddess directly, so he summons Robin, or Puck, to help him cast a spell on her. The flower they need is the pansy, which acquired its great property of inspiring love from a miscast arrow of Cupid that landed on the flower. Act 2, Scene 1, lines 165 through 174 inclusive. So now this flower, also referred to as love in idleness, causes instant affection, regardless of the object's worthiness or unworthiness. Act 2, Scene 1, line 165. The pansy, then, serves as an emblem of the power that Helena invested in love itself when she said in Act 1, Scene 1, quote unquote, things base and vile, holding no quantity, love can transpose to form and dignity. Apparently, this flower has unrestricted power to kindle and shift libidinal energy. It is Eros, stripped of the restraint of cultural norms and limitations. Oberon hopes by this device to extort the Indian boy from Titania in exchange for releasing her from whatever unpleasant love relation the flower imposes upon her. Thou shalt fly him, and he shall seek thy love. Oberon sees how unhappy Helena is as she pleads with Demetrius and determines to make things right, but gives Robin vague instructions that will soon cause him to bewitch the wrong Athenian man. Still in Act 2, Scene 1, now that his plan with regard to Hippolyta has been duly hatched, Oberon has time to observe the distressing goings-on between Demetrius and Helena. Demetrius continues to scorn the fair Athenian maid, who would gladly sacrifice her dignity to undo his indifference. As she admits to him, she adores him all the more for his disdain. Quote unquote, "I am your spaniel, and, Demetrius, the more you beat me, I will fawn on you." Act 2, Scene 1, lines 203 through 204. Helena is so determined that she would reverse the usual course of the Ovidian love chase. Quote unquote, "Apollo flies and Daphne holds the chase," she says to Demetrius, even though she herself considers this inappropriate for a woman. Act 2, Scene 1, line 241. As Helena laments, quote unquote, "We cannot fight for love as men may do. We should be wooed, and we're not made to woo." Act 2, Scene 1, lines 241 through 242. Seeing her distress, then, Oberon takes pity on Helena and decides to help her. "Matters are not up to Demetrius," says the fairy king. Quote unquote, "Ere he do leave this grove, thou shalt fly him, and he shall seek thy love." Act 2, Scene 1, lines 245 through 246. Just then, Robin arrives with the magical flower Theseus needs. He himself will use it to bewitch Titania, while Robin's orders are to fix the issue between Demetrius and Helena. Theseus's vague command, however, will cause a deal of trouble. Quote unquote, "Thou shalt know the man," he tells Robin, quote unquote, "by the Athenian garments he hath on." Act 2, Scene 1, lines 263 through 264. "Nay, good Lysander, Ellipsis, do not lie so near." Oberon bewitches Hippolyta with pansy juice, but Robin mistakenly bewitches Lysander instead of Demetrius. In Act 2, Scene 2, Titania enters, gives some orders, and calls for a fairy song to lull her to sleep. Even though the fairies around her sing a song of protection for their queen, once she is asleep, the fairy king Oberon easily gains access to her side. Drop goes the pansy juice into Titania's eyes, along with a little prayer that ends, quote unquote, "When thou wak'st, it is thy dear. Wake when some vile thing is near." Act 2, Scene 2, lines 33 through 34. And so, Oberon unleashes on his queen the more indecorous, even degrading aspect of Eros, the power of love. In come Hermia and Lysander, both tired half to death, and they make their sleeping arrangements. Lysander is all for, quote-unquote, "one bed in the forest." But Hermia firmly favors chastity as a key element of decorum, fitness of attitude and conduct. Quote-unquote, "Nay, good Lysander," she says, quote-unquote, "for my sake, my dear, lie further off yet. Do not lie so near." Act 2, Scene 2, lines 43 through 44. Soon enough, though, both are fast asleep after pledging their lifelong loyalty. The transformations enjoined by Oberon are supposed to yield predictable results, but it's hard to control such a magical power. Robin enters, a bit frustrated that so far he has been unable to find the Athenian youth that his master wants him to bewitch. But at last he comes upon Lysander sleeping separately from Hermia. Robin mistakenly sprinkles Lysander's eyes with the pansy juice that should have been sprinkled over the eyes of Demetrius. Act 2, Scene 2, lines 76 through 81. Robin, a member of the forest spirit world, makes this mistake because he can't process the fact that Lysander and Hermia are sleeping apart only because they respect the human custom of chastity before marriage. It isn't that they are upset with each other. Puck is a natural creature and cares nothing for customs of that sort or concepts like chastity. To him, Lysander seems like a quote-unquote lack love and a kill courtesy, not a proper man. Act 2, Scene 2, line 77. Reason becomes the marshal to my will and leads me to your eyes. Demetrius abandons Helena, but Lysander awakes to the sight of her and falls in love. Helena is afraid Lysander is mocking her, and Hermia, upon waking, goes looking for him. Still in Act 2, Scene 2, Helena and Demetrius rush in, squabbling over his disdain for her, which has shattered her confidence. That is no surprise, since here, love is figured as a zero-sum game, in which there must be winners and losers, and a species of often cruel exclusivity reigns. Consonantly, the pansy flower transfers love from one object to another. Its love magic is not of the aggregative sort. Even in the forest, there is to be no hippie-like free love. Helena stands directly above the sleeping Lysander. No sooner does the young man wake up than he falls in love with Helena, and, therefore, out of love with his beloved of a few minutes back, Hermia. Way to go, Robin Goodfellow. Comically, Lysander claims that his newfound love is entirely grounded in humankind's highest faculty. He says to Helena, quote-unquote, "Reason becomes the marshal to my will and leads me to your eyes." Act 2, Scene 2, lines 120 through 121. A downcast Helena can hardly believe that Lysander would mock her this way, knowing of her troubles with Demetrius. Quote-unquote, "When at your hands did I deserve this scorn?" she demands of Lysander. Act 2, Scene 2, line 124. In return, he is able only to cast himself as a chivalrous knight, even as he trashes his now-loathed ex, Hermia. Lysander bids still-sleeping Hermia to stay far from him, saying that he hates her as, quote-unquote, "a surfeit of the sweetest things the deepest loathing to the stomach brings." Act 2, Scene 2, lines 137 through 138. How similar a pronouncement, and yet how different a sentiment, that is, from Duke Orsino's lyrical observation at the beginning of Twelfth Night. Quote unquote, "If music be the food of love, play on, give me excess of it, that surfeiting the appetite may sicken and so die." Hermia now awakes and can scarcely believe that Lysander isn't near her side, so she can recount to him her bad dream. Quote unquote, "Methought a serpent ate my heart away," she begins, and decides to go off in search of her, Lysander. Act 2, Scene 2, line 149. Well, at least Oberon carried out his part of the plan properly. He began the scene by squeezing pansy juice onto Titania's eyelids. Act 2, Scene 2, lines 27 through 34, inclusive. She remains asleep at the end of the second act, but not for long. Thanks for listening. This audio lecture was recorded on Friday, July 4th, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations from A Midsummer Night's Dream, I have relied on the revised Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume, genre-based format.